From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, finding inner peace. I guess we could all do that. Here's what's happening. Two rockets hit near the U.S. Embassy in Iraq's capital hours after the ambassador was summoned over a U.S. strike that killed the top Iraqi and Iranian commanders. The attack was the second night in a row that the Green Zone was hit, and the 14th time over the last 2 months that the U.S. installations have been targeted. That happened Sunday night. Iran's supreme leader wept in grief with hundreds of thousands of mourners along Tehran's streets for the funeral of military commander Qassem Soleimani, killed by a U.S. drone on the orders of U.S. President Donald Trump. And, of course, contrary to Donald Trump's tweets, the U.S. military says they will not target Iranian cultural centers at all. Let's check in, though, with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com, to get his take and give us an update on today's actions. John, what do you think?
Well, you know, you have this is a long history with Iran. And we're talking about the Islamic Revolution in 1979, sacking a U.S. embassy, taking 52 hostages. I mean, when Trump talked about 52 sites, he was referring, you know, to those 52 hostages that were held 444 days, you know, until Ronald Reagan was sworn in, you know, in January 20th, 1981. But prior to that, George, we have to remember who these people are and what the U.S. is dealing with here. And what we, I mean, what happened in 1983 at the Marine Barracks in Beirut, Lebanon, was absolutely astonishing shocker to a lot of Americans when it was truck bombed by Hezbollah. And that's the same group that basically stormed the U.S. embassy.
Yeah.
Now, anybody, George, anyone who does not believe that the U.S. has a right to respond to an attack on its sovereignty at its embassy, where they were taking a battering ram and trying to break through the door, and this was orchestrated by Soleimani, and this was in coordination with Al-Muhandris over there, who's the head of Hezbollah, the militia. So when you're talking about attacking a U.S. embassy, Trump didn't want this to turn into another Benghazi, or worse yet, another Tehran embassy where those hostages were seized. He had had enough. And I think what it signals is a Trump doctrine right now that people are starting to get used to. In this country, with the amount of extreme propaganda that goes on in the media, not just, neutral publications, we're talking about, you know, the politicization of this by the Democrat Party right now is outrageous. Our embassy was attacked, and he responded with a high-value target of taking out a mass murderer that David Petraeus said today was far more devastating to U.S. interests in Soleimani in setting up all these Shiite militias all over, you know, the Middle East and North Africa, staging a proxy war that has been going on since 2015 against Saudi Arabia, arming Houthi rebels, arming Hamas terrorists, arming Hezbollah. I mean, these are bad people. This is state-sponsored terrorism at the highest level. And for anyone to suggest that the U.S. did not have probable cause in self-defense of taking out these two characters in Baghdad, it's just clueless. Trump had every right, legally and otherwise, and you hear, you know, the rumblings in Congress right now. You know, this is, before the big dog and pony impeachment trial goes on, of them talking about Trump under the War Powers Act doesn't have the right to respond. Well, we all know about the War Powers Act, and that, yes, a president under, you know, Article 2 has a right to respond to threats to U.S.
Well,
national
and what's
security.
Happening now, John, too, is the United Nations is now questioning the legality of the drone attack. So we'll see what happens there, too. And, of course, as you just mentioned, the impeachment proceedings, they still don't even know if it's going to end up in trial or not. That's how screwed up everything is right now. Thank you. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. As Gerald Celente predicted last night on our program, gold surged to its highest since 2013 as rising tensions in the Middle East stoked demand for these gold havens, with Goldman Sachs Group seeing more room to run. Palladium, by the way, another metal, extended gains to a fresh record as well. Borden, that's right, the milk company, one of America's oldest and largest dairy companies, became the second major milk producer to file for bankruptcy in the last 2 months. Tumbling milk consumption combined with the rising price of milk have crippled the dairy industry with debt. Dean Foods, America's largest milk producer, filed for bankruptcy back a few months ago. Well, trust your gut, right? It's a cliche we've all heard about. Now they're saying it's actually good advice. In a newspaper published in the Journal of Behavioral and Experimental Economics, a trio of British economists applied some brain power to the question of gut feelings and found that people who second-guess themselves make considerably worse decisions. How about that? The moon likely lost its magnetic field after an internal dynamo stopped firing about a billion years ago, according to a new study. What a story that is. What else is going on in the skies? Time for Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, George. Happy New Year to you and the listeners. Wow, we got a lot of stuff here to talk about. We begin with space, and I'm sure many people may know now SpaceX's first launch of 2020, a great success, and the Space Force is moving full force. With the successful launch, George, of another of these SpaceX rockets placing 60 or so of these Starlink satellites into low Earth orbit. It was helped supported by the 45th Space Wing. And these SpaceX little satellites, the Starlinks, are kind of interesting. They go up to about 180 miles in orbit first, and then their little ion thrusters move them to a more secure orbit, about 341 miles high. But, George, this is interesting for the listeners when we always talk about the live sky. The Starlink train, this entire cluster of some 60 satellites, is somewhat easy to see if you know when and where to look. My suggestion to the listeners, just Google tracking Starlink satellites. I'm doing it right now. And the cluster is now way past Madagascar, moving into the southern Indian Ocean, into daylight. But what's interesting about this, George, as we've talked about before, is many in the astronomy world are concerned because the telescopes are taking pictures of galaxies, and sometimes their field, more than often, gets obscured by some of the Starlink, so space is simply crowded. In astronomy, George, Betelgeuse, the star that we've been talking about, still a hot topic in the news. This red-orange supergiant star is easy to see after sunset. The star is in the upper left armpit area of the constellation Orion and has been fading, and that's something people are talking about, whether or not it may go supernova. For those with more advanced knowledge of astronomy, the star shows, and I've been watching it just a few hours ago, at plus 1.4 on the magnitude scale, or plus 1.5, meaning it's dimming. And in 2 months, the star has dropped from the 10th most brilliant star in the sky to the 21st. Is a supernova coming? Maybe not, maybe yes. But the star varies, George, with a distinct variability period, one every 5.9 years, as astronomers tell us, and one in every 425 days, two separate things. And simply, we may just be going through a period where we have what's called a super minimum, but you never know, George, this one may indeed go supernova, so we'll keep our eyes to the skies.
Super.
Wrapping it up with the live sky, we say the Earth now, nearest and closest to the sun, the moon waxing, moving on to its beautiful first full moon of the year. That occurs Friday, the full wolf moon. And for planets, as we wrap it up, Venus dominates the sky in the southwest, George, and we're hearing that Venus may still have active volcanoes. That's interesting. Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies and email me. Appreciate all the emails throughout the year and the year to come and the year now. DrSkyShow@gmail.com. And check the great websites we promote, livesky.com and wikisky.org. Thank you, George.
Talk to you next week, Dr. Sky, as we roll into 2020 now in a big, quick way as well. In a moment, Douglas Rushkoff joins us. We're going to be talking about man versus machine and some other issues in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Dorey with you. Let me introduce Dr. Douglas Rushkoff. He is a professor of media theory and digital economics at City University of New York. He's the author of 20-plus books, including Life, Inc., Present Shock, Program or Be Programmed, and the latest, Team Human. He is the host of the Team Human podcast, and he made PBS documentaries, Merchants of Cool, Digital Nation, Generation Like. He also wrote the graphic novels Testament and Alistair and Adolf. Fascinating stories there. Douglas, welcome back to the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you, George.
How was life? How were your holidays?
Pretty good. You know, it's kind of chaotic out there, but you know, it makes me value all the more getting to, you know, sit with people around a table and make some eye contact and breathe with people. You know, it's funny. You know, the word conspiracy really just means to breathe together, conspire, breathe together, and it's sort of feels like that right now. When you get in with your family, you turn off the TV and make the kids get off the phones and actually look in each other's eyes, you remember, oh my gosh, we're just we're human beings here together, and there's a whole lot of power in that sort of solidarity that we find in these holiday events.
Douglas, your work is absolutely amazing. How did you get involved in all of this in the first place?
It's interesting. You know, I was a theater person. I was a theater geek from high school.
Yeah, and I was like you were in plays in high school and things like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did that too.
Directing plays when I was 11 years old.
Wow.
I just loved it. And I was going to go into theater. You know, I did all my pre-medical requirements at Princeton the way my parents wanted me to, so I could fall back on a medical career. But, you know, theater was my love. And I got a little bit tired of theater in the 1980s. It was so expensive for people to go. I felt like all my audiences were just the same kind of people coming in and paying their money, and that was sort of their way of paying tribute to whatever the subject matter of the play was. And right along the same time, the internet was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And my strangest, most artistic friends from college, the ones you would least expect to be interested in computers, all ended up moving out to California to the Bay Area. I mean, these were real weird people, acid heads, you know, total Grateful Dead heads, strangest people. And they're getting jobs at Intel and Apple. And so I headed out there to find out what is going on. Why are the weirdest people in the world getting involved in this stuff? And I fell into the biggest news story of the century, I think, and ended up writing the very first books and articles on virtual reality and email and the internet. And, you know, I was writing stuff that I remember I used to get laughed out of editors' meetings when I would say, oh, maybe we should do an article on on this thing called the internet or on email. And they would say, oh, please. And, of course, you know, it turned out to be a big story, and I was there. And, you know, 10 books later, I was me.
I was with a friend of mine tonight, Douglas, and a song popped up in a little restaurant we were in, and I didn't know who the artists were or the name of the song. And he held up his phone to the speaker. He just held it up. And I'm looking at him going, what are you doing? And he said, watch this. And then he pulls his phone back, and it digitally reads out the name of the song and the artists from the 1970s. And I went, this is unbelievable. It's an app, I guess you could pick up. This technology with these smartphones is seriously the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
It is. And when it's used that way, you know, that a person voluntarily turns on his phone and opens up the app and says what song is playing, that's beautiful. You know, the problem is we've gotten to the place where the phone might be listening to that music, to following him around, trying to figure out what kind of a person he is based on what music he's listening to. And that's where we move into that other side of tech that I've been sort of writing about the last 10 years, which is more what happens when instead of us using our technology starts using us.
And that's a very real dark side, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's where most of the industry is going. You know, when you think about you swipe your smartphone. Every time you swipe your smartphone's getting smarter about you, and you're getting dumber about it, you know?
And the more we want to find out about what's going on inside that phone, the more we find out, oh, well, you know, that technology is in this thing we call a black box, and you're not allowed to look in there because that technology is proprietary. So we're not even allowed to know what our phones are doing to us, even if we had the technological chops to look in there and see what it was.
The CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, is going on in Las Vegas, and the big talk right now is the massive amount of brand new technological advances in surveillance. Cameras, audio, it's everywhere. I mean, we're going to get to a point, Douglas, if we're not there already, where everything we do is witnessed by video, isn't it?
Right. And if you look at something like CES, the interesting thing is it isn't just all the surveillance technology that's everywhere, but the things they use to convince us to want to install this stuff in our homes. As if, oh, someone's trying to rob you, someone's going to try to sneak in your back door, there's bad people listening on your phone. So we willingly put these cameras. I remember back in the day, back in the Art Bell era, in the early 80s, I remember listening, and they would talk about how, you know, people were going to get, you know, chips inserted into their blood.
Yeah, we're still talking about that.
You know, but now you don't need the chip. You're walking around with the chip.
It's in your hand, holding it.
Exactly. They didn't need to force us to do anything.
Well, that's an interesting take. You're right. Some companies have asked their employees to get chipped, but you're right. It's in your phone.
Yeah. And the ones who are chipped, I mean, usually that's a weird moment, isn't it? They're putting chips in workers, and now, you know, Honda's building these things called exoskeletons that you put on the worker. It's the idea is it's a little bit like those kind of belts that a FedEx worker wears so that they don't hurt their back when they're picking up a big box. And it's this skeleton that you put on your whole body, and it can give your arms, you know, some bionic sort of strength and all. But really what you're doing when you put on one of these suits is you're training the suit how to do all the things that you do.
That's right.
The thing that people don't realize is that the human flesh inside one of these suits or machines, that's the temporary part. That's the part that they're hoping to replace with gears someday soon.
Douglas Ruskoff with us. His latest book is called Team Human. We're going to take calls with him next hour. Maybe you could even share some of your stories that technologically things have happened to you that you might want to share with us. Last week, I had a story that Mark Zuckerberg's net worth is now up to like $27 billion from just Facebook. It's a stock value, but it's, my God, here's a guy from Harvard with his buddies putting together this little social network. Did he ever think it would explode like this?
You know, I knew the net would explode like this. I didn't think Facebook would explode quite like that. And it's interesting. Now he says he wants to give back, you know, 90% of his money, you know, and because it was way more profitable than he even needed. And the thing I always ask then is, well, then you didn't need to make the platform quite as awful as you did either. You know, if you had made it, you know, 90% less profitable, mm-hmm. it might have also been 90% less manipulative. You know?
That's true.
You know, and so Facebook, it's not a platform I like to use, because the underlying logic of Facebook is it records everything we do, it stores data about our past in order to manipulate our future. You know, Facebook's technology, the most brilliant thing they can do is they can determine with about 80% accuracy what it is you're going to do next. They know before you do if you're going to decide to get divorced, if you're getting sick, if you're going to go on a diet. But then what they do is if they know with 80% likelihood that George Norrie is going to go on a diet, then what they're going to do is start filling your newsfeed with stories about, oh, look what happens when your veins get too much fat in it.
Amazing. You're right. You are so right.
And they're not doing it to sell a specific diet to you, but to get that 20% of people who didn't go on a diet, to get that percentage down. They want to get their accuracy up from 80% to 90%.
Well, I noticed several years ago, Douglas, you know, if you would go online to look at shoes, for example, all of a sudden, if you go to Google or any site, shoes would start popping up all over the place. And I realize they're following you, aren't they?
Yeah, they're following and they're sharing. They hand you off. We just have this guy. Well, we almost sold him a pair of shoes. Here, now you go for it. You know, they're all sharing and talking to each other on there. And then, you know, a lot of people, have you ever had that experience when you've just talked about something on the phone, and then you go online, and somehow, magically, there's an ad for the thing you were talking about?
Oh, my gosh. You're going to have to tell us how that happens when we come back in a moment. Douglas Rushkoff with us, calls with him next hour. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, back with Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas, I got to ask you about your Alistair and Adolf next hour, that fascinating occult book. But you were talking about being on the phone, and they somehow track and follow you. And did you want to get into that again?
Sure. I mean, it's funny. You might be having a phone conversation with a nephew or someone, and you mention, I'm going to have to buy a new baby seat or something for you. And then, you know, you go on the internet, and all of a sudden there's like an ad for a baby seat there. And naturally, we assume, oh my gosh, they're listening in on the call.
Right.
You know, the sort of the Ed Snowden thing where, you know, the NSA is listening in on every call. And while they are doing that, that's not how they get the baby seat on there. It's almost scarier to realize the way they figured out about the baby seat has nothing to do with hearing your conversation and everything to do with watching all of your behaviors online. And not even the content of your email or the specific sites that you're going to, but they're analyzing everything. It's how rapidly you click on your mouse, what you hover over with your pointer, how many times you've checked your Snapchat that day, or if you've gone on Twitter between 10 and 10:15 or 10:15 and 10:30. They lump you into these big statistical buckets, and there's enough people and enough data using all this that they can figure out that, oh my gosh, people who have this combination of 9 keystrokes are 70% likely to want to be getting a baby holder for their car, and they'll throw the ad at you. So the weirdest thing is that this is the way the algorithms see us.
It's amazing technology, though. Jeez.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, and it's just predictive algorithms. But then when you think about it, I mean, for me, these are kind of the dark arts that I'm really concerned about. This is why I wrote Team Human, is kind of to arm people against this and to fortify their resistance. That for me, these algorithms are almost like demons. I mean, think about it. You build a piece of code. You teach it how to look for vulnerabilities in a human being, and then how to leverage those vulnerabilities to get us to act often against our own best interests.
Well, you're gonna get a kick out of this, Douglas. A couple of years ago, I got an email from one of our listeners who said, George, I've been looking at the website of your guest for tonight, and he's got some very inappropriate stuff on his website, if I were you, I'd cancel the guest. And so I emailed him back, and I said, what do you mean by inappropriate? And he said, there's stuff there, and he explained it to me, and it's so bad, I don't want to mention it on the air, but you can get a picture of that. So I go to the guy's website, the guest, and everything's fine. And I'm looking at it, I go back again an hour later. Everything's fine. All his stuff is fine. His ads are fine. It dawned on me that this guy, the listener, was looking at inappropriate material, and it followed him to this guy's website.
Exactly. What people don't realize is that, you know, your Google search results are different than my Google search.
Exactly.
The ads that you get are the different ones than I get. Your Facebook feed is different than my Facebook feed. And that's why we're so screwed up as a society right now. I mean, it used to be bad enough back in the day when we would argue about things, but at least we were seeing the same thing and then arguing about it. Now we're arguing about things, but we're seeing different things. We're being presented different pictures of the world. And the dark part, I mean, the part that bothers me is that this is not random. This is by design. This is a divide and conquer approach to humanity. They're preventing us from finding common ground, because the more isolated we are, the more alienated we are from one another, the better customers we are. The whole design of the interactive space, of the digital space, is to keep us back in our reptile brain, to keep us responding automatically. They do that by showing us the equivalent of car crashes. You know, whether you're on the pro-Trump side or the anti-Trump side, you're going to see images that get you really upset. And that's because when you're upset, you can be more easily manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
You can be more easily sent to one place or another. You know, there's a whole division at Stanford University called captology that technology developers go through. And captology, just like it sounds, is the study of how to capture people online, how to addict them and manipulate their behavior. They port the algorithms from Las Vegas slot machines into our Facebook news feeds, into our Snapchat. And that's because they're using what's called behavioral finance in order to modify human behavior to get us clicking on buy buttons and just clicking, you know, just engaged online in that strange panicked state. Then we come out into the world and we hear about, oh, you know, Trump did something to Iran or Iran did something to us, and everything is panic. Everything is catastrophe.
Instantly.
And you can't approach any problem. You can't do anything. You can't even engage with your family and your friends if you believe you're in the midst of a catastrophe.
Earlier today, Douglas, a brigadier general had a letter that he compiled that said that we were going to leave Iraq. Our troops were going to leave. And it hit all the websites. I mean, I'm getting these notifications like crazy. And I'm going, oh, all right, this is interesting. Like 10 minutes later, there's a retraction from our government. No, this is not true. We're not leaving. This was an honest mistake. It's not happening. What are the dangers of things getting out there so fast, uncooperated, unchecked, and they start panic or whatever?
Well, the danger, I mean, gosh, now I'm really going to sound old, and I wasn't alive for it, but the danger is Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. You know?
Oh, yeah.
The original fake news, only that was being done as a joke. That was Halloween.
And people missed the disclaimer at the top of the show.
Yeah. And even though they put a disclaimer, as we all know, you know, people were piling into their cars and trying to get away from the U.S. coast because they were afraid of the alien invasion. And we're in an equivalent state now where one way or another, almost every piece of media that we're looking at is telling us you are in danger. You know, the world is ending. These people are not your friends. And that's what I'm trying to fight against. That's why I came up with this kind of this Team Human meme. You know, partly it's to say, like, Team Human against the robots, you know, that I don't think we're going to get replaced. I don't want to upload my consciousness to a chip. I think, you know, that even if this singularity is coming, I don't think human beings have to pass the evolutionary torch to our robot successors and accept our inevitable extinction. I think we deserve a place in the digital future. But I'm also arguing that being human is a team sport. You know, we've bought this really cockamamie understanding of evolution as competition for survival between everybody. Evolution's no more the story of competition than it is of collaboration, of the way that trees share resources through their root systems. They're not crowding each other out for sunlight. They're sharing their energy with one another through a living system of roots and mushrooms that take a service fee for the transfer. And human beings are like that too. We're at our best when we're connected for real to one another, which was the original intent of the internet. I was there. I remember. These were loving, open-minded, kind of hippie, psychedelic people thinking that the internet could connect humanity, could be the brain for the spirit of Gaia on the planet.
Sure.
It's way out. But we're using it for the opposite now. We're using it to divide and conquer and to amplify some of the oldest and most extractive anti-human agendas that, you know, the original the original dominator agenda of Pharaoh, you know, is really coming through these technologies today.
I am opposed to driverless vehicles, especially driverless trucks, because I don't want to see our truck drivers put out of work.
Yeah.
Isn't technology going so far? It's going too far?
Yeah, well, I mean, the idea of an automatic truck is not bad in itself. It's more a matter of we're using it to amplify the worst effects of an extractive economy. You know, we're taking drivers, and they're not only driving the vehicle, right? And they should be paid for that. They're driving the vehicle across the country, but they're also training their robot replacements in real time as they drive. You know, every Uber driver out there is not just getting slave wages for driving us around when they could be or should be driving a cab like a human being, but they're training their replacements. I mean, if they owned the company, if it was some kind of a cooperative, then at least they're going to have shares in the robot, you know.
Sure, but they don't.
No, they don't. They're being exploited, as are all. I mean, and truckers understand it better than anybody. Construction workers too. If they look at their construction material, the machines they're using now, you know, the Caterpillar and John Deere and everything else, there's AI on these things. You know, and that's not just to help the construction person build a better place. It's to teach the machine how to do it without the human being. You know, and that would be fine if you're going to pay the person. Say, look, you've trained all our trucks. You and your family now get royalties on these trucks forever. That's great. You know, and then you can do something else. You know, learn other things if you want. But that's not what they're saying. They just want to replace and discard. They're discarding the human contribution. That's every single digital business plan has to do with how do we have less people? How do we get rid of the people
and save money doing it?
Right.
What's the upside to this kind of technology? Is there any?
Well, there's a lot of upsides if we can embed them with human values. I mean, I've got no problem with robots tilling the soil and the farmer getting to spend a lot of time watching his robots and drinking iced tea as they do the work. You know, there is a future, a balanced future, where we use technology to do things that are, you know, difficult or painful for human beings to do. You know, like right now, to build a cell phone, they still have to send a kid in Africa into a cave at gunpoint to get their rare earth metals. You know, that's blood on our hands. You know, these are not. It's just like blood diamonds. These rare earth metals are dangerous to get. I mean, so sure, we could be using tech to do that, but it's really a matter of looking at what technology do people need, rather than what technology can we build to exploit people more, to repress their humanity, to keep them from talking to each other, to take more of their stuff. You know, we're looking at a very old, what the Native Americans called a disease. You know, when the colonizers came to North America, they thought they had such faith in humans, they couldn't believe that we would just tear down forests and enslave people and kill like that. So they said we had a disease that they called it Wetiko. They thought it was a spiritual disease that led us to want to just dominate others and take their things and extract their value. And I think we're still suffering from that disease, that we don't realize that it's so much easier to include your neighbors in the profit that you're making rather than to try to exclude them, that your success is not dependent on someone else's failure, that you do better when everyone does better. We need to teach, even Walmart, we have to teach them, no, you know, that actually if your customers and employees are wealthier, you're going to do better as a business, not worse. The wealthier your customers are, the more they can spend with you.
That's right. Douglas,
it's kind of that simple.
With the way things are moving, here we are 2020. What do you think things will look like and be like in 2025? Only 5 years from now, which will be like that.
It's interesting. You know, it's easier for us to imagine like the zombie apocalypse of the future of 50 years from now than it is to imagine what happens just 5 years from now. I mean, I have to believe that over the next 5 years, more people are going to wake up to what it is that we're talking about here. You know, either because they're too poor to keep buying all of this tech, eventually you just can't get the iPhone 20 or the Android 1000, you know, and as you fall behind, things start to work. I mean, it's like, oh, I can't use that app. And you start to look up. I mean, what I'm doing in New York now, and I'm starting to notice it turning around. I walked around the streets, and I never have my cell phone. I'm never looking at it. But I always see, like, everybody just staring in their phones as they're walking.
Oh, I can't believe they don't smash into poles and other
people.
They do,
or into each other, into the street, and the taxi cabs. But every once in a while, I notice somebody else looking up. And I make eye contact with that person, and it feels like we're in a secret club of the humans, like in Body Snatchers. Like, oh, there's another one who hasn't been snatched. But I'm finding now, over the last year, more and more people are looking up. I'm having that experience more and more. So I think people are realizing they're getting almost nauseous with their devices. And yes, I know your nephew or your cousin is on Facebook and they had a kid or whatever, but you could just find out about that, and okay, great, but they're not here right now. There's somebody is here right now. There's your neighbor. There's your coworker. There's your friend. And these people are coming to the realization that their real-world experiences have so much more bandwidth, to use a tech term, than any Skype connection, that you can establish rapport, look into someone's eyes, see if their pupils are getting larger or smaller, see if their breathing is syncing up with yours. That, you know, it fires the mirror neurons in your brain and releases oxytocin into your bloodstream, which is the bonding hormone. And all of a sudden, you feel really different. You don't feel alone. You found another person. You've begun on that process. So I think 5 years from now, we will be much more social. I think we're going to look back on this red-blue state thing just 5 years from now and realize, oh, wow, that's not us. They did that to us. I'm not a red person. I'm not a blue person. I'm just a person. And this whole thing has been imposed on us by an industry that's looking to make money off these divisions.
Oh, that's the name of the game for them.
Yep. Yep. And they don't need it. That's the thing. When you look at Zuckerberg with his billions, they don't even need it. They don't need that money. It's just they're just as addicted to this as anybody else.
And then you look at somebody like Jeff Bezos, who used the internet to sell goods and made billions doing it.
You know, and to on a certain level, it created great convenience, right? I can get my book out to a lot more people, of course, with much less profit than you get from a regular bookstore.
But you can get it out to the masses.
Right. It's out there, and now that he's got these practically $1 trillion, you figure he could start to do something good with that money. I mean, he thinks the thing
He's doing some space stuff, so
right. But that's because he wants to, like a lot of the billionaires, he wants to escape. They realize they've screwed up our planet and screwed up our society. They're looking to get off.
They want to go to Mars or someplace.
Right. Or they're building. I did a talk for what I thought was going to be a talk. It turned out it was five billionaires came into the green room, and they wanted advice on where to put their bunkers, New Zealand or Alaska, how to maintain control of their security force after their money.
I believe they seriously would do that, too. Douglas, we're going to take a break. It's the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk more. I want to talk a little bit about your occult novel, Alistair and Adolf. And, of course, we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.